Chapter 5. Madame Epanchin was jealous of the dignity of her family. What must it have been for her to hear without the slightest preparation that this Prince Mushkin, the last of the family, of whom she had heard something already, was no better than a poor idiot, was almost a beggar, and was ready to accept charity? The general reckoned on making an effect, impressing her at once, turning her attention in another direction, and avoiding the question of the pearls under cover of this sensation. When anything extraordinary happened, Madame Epanchin used to open her eyes very wide, and, throwing back her whole person, she would stare vaguely before her without uttering a word. She was a woman of large build, and of the same age as her husband, with dark hair, still thick, though getting very grey. She was rather thin, with a somewhat aquiline nose, sunken yellow cheeks and thin, drawn-in lips. Her forehead was high but narrow. Her large grey eyes had sometimes a most unexpected expression. She had once had the weakness to fancy that her eyes were particularly effective, and nothing had been able to efface the conviction.
"Receive him? But receive him now, at once!"
And the lady opened her eyes to their very widest, gazing at Ivan Fyodorovitch as he fidgeted before her.
"Oh, as far as that goes, there's no need of ceremony. If only you don't mind seeing him, my dear," the general hastened to explain. "He is quite a child and such a pathetic figure. He has some sort of fits. He has just arrived from Switzerland, came straight from the station. He's queerly dressed, like a German, and not a penny, literally. He's almost crying. I gave him 25 roubles and want to find him some little post as a clerk in our office. And I beg you, madame, to offer him lunch, for I think he is hungry, too."
"You amaze me," Madame Epanchin went on as before. "Hungry and fits. What sort of fits?"
"Oh, they don't occur so frequently. And besides, he is like a child, but well-educated. I should like to ask you, madame," he addressed his daughters again, "to put him through an examination. It would be as well to know what he is fit for."
"An examination," drawled his wife,
and in the utmost astonishment she rolled her eyes from her husband to her daughters and back again.
"Oh, my dear, don't take it in that sense. But, of course, it's just as you please. I was meaning to be friendly to him and introduce him to the family, because it's almost an act of charity."
"Introduce him to the family? From Switzerland?"
"Well, that's no drawback. But I repeat again, it's as you like. I thought of it because, in the first place, he is of the same name, and perhaps a relation. And besides, he's nowhere to lay his head. I supposed it would be rather interesting to you to see him, in fact, because, after all, he belongs to the same family."
"Of course, maman. If one needn't stand on ceremony with him. Besides, he must be hungry after the journey. Why not give him something to eat, if he has nowhere to go?"
said the eldest girl, Alexandra.
"And if he is a perfect child, too, we could have a game of blind man's buff with him."
"Blind man's buff? What do you mean?"
"Oh, maman, please leave off pretending," Aglaia interrupted in vexation.
The second daughter, Adelaida, who was of mirthful disposition, could not restrain herself and burst out laughing.
"Send for him, Papa. Maman gives you leave," Aglaia decided.
The general rang and told the servant to call the prince.
"But on condition he has a napkin tied round his neck when he sits at the table," his wife insisted. "Call Fyodor, or Mavra, to stand behind his chair and look after him while he eats. I only trust he is quiet when he has a fit. Does he wave his arms?"
"Oh, quite the opposite. He is very well bred and has charming manners. He is just a little simple sometimes. Oh, but here he is. Come, let me introduce Prince Mushkin, the last of the name, your namesake, and perhaps your kinsman. Make him welcome and be kind to him. Lunch will be served directly, Prince. So, do us the honour. But excuse me, I must hurry off. I'm late."
"We know where you are hurrying off to," observed his wife majestically.
"I'm in a hurry. I'm in a hurry, my dear. I'm late. Give him your albums, madame. Let him write something there for you. His handwriting is something exquisite.
You should see how he wrote out for me in the old world characters. The Abbot Pafnuti put his hand there too. Well, goodbye. Pafnuti? The Abbot? Stop a minute. Stop a minute. Where are you off to? And who is this Pafnuti? His wife called with distinct annoyance and almost agitation after her escaping spouse. Yes, my dear, it was an abbot who lived in old days. But I'm off to the Count's. I ought to have been there long ago. He fixed the hour himself. Goodbye for the present, Prince. The general retired with rapid steps.
I know what Count he is going to see,
Lizaveta Prokofievna pronounced sharply, and she turned her eyes irritably to the Prince.
What was it?
She began peevishly and grumpily, trying to remember.
Well, what was it? Yes. What about...
Maman,
Alexandra was beginning, and Aglaya even stamped her foot.
Don't interfere with me, Alexandra Ivanovna,
snapped the mother.
I want to know, too. Sit here, Prince. Here, on this easy chair, opposite me. No, here. Move into the sun, nearer the light, so that I may see you. Well, what abbot?
The Abbot Pafnuti,
answered Mushkin attentively and seriously.
Pafnuti? That's interesting. Well, what about him?
The lady asked her questions impatiently, rapidly, sharply, keeping her eyes fixed on the prince, and when Mushkin answered, she nodded her head at every word.
The Abbot Pafnuti of the 14th century, began Mushkin. He was at the head of a monastery on the Volga in what is now the province of Kostroma. He was famous for his holy life. He visited the Tartars, helped in the management of public affairs, and signed some document. I've seen a copy of the signature. I liked the handwriting, and I imitated it. When the general wanted to see my writing just now, so as to find me a job, I wrote several phrases in different handwritings, and among others I wrote, "The Abbot Pafnuti put his hand there too," in the abbot's own handwriting. The general liked it very much, and so he spoke of it just now.
"Aglaya," said Madame Epanchin, "remember Pafnuti, or better write it down, else I always forget. But I thought it would be more interesting. Where is this signature?"
"I think it was left in the general study on the table."
"Send at once and fetch it."
"Hadn't I better write it again for you, if you like?"
"Of course, maman,"
said Alexandra.
"But now we had better have lunch. We are hungry."
"Quite so,"
assented her mother.
"Come along, Prince. Are you very hungry?"
Yes, I've begun to be very hungry now, and I'm very grateful to you.
It's a very good thing that you are polite, and I notice you are not nearly such a queer creature as you were described. Come along. Sit here facing me."
She insisted on making Mushkin sit down when they went into the dining room.
"I want to look at you. Alexandra, Adelaida, help the prince to something. He's really not such an invalid, is he? Perhaps the table napkin is not necessary. Used you to have a napkin tied round your neck at mealtimes, Prince?"
"Long ago, when I was 7, I believe I did. But now I usually have my napkin on my knee at mealtimes."
"Quite right. And your fits?"
"Fits?" The prince was a little surprised.
"My fits don't happen very often now. But I don't know. I'm told the climate here will make me worse."
"He speaks well,"
said the lady, turning to her daughters. She still nodded her head at every word Mushkin uttered.
"I didn't expect it. So it was all stuff and nonsense, as usual. Help yourself, Prince, and tell me where you were born and where you've been brought up. I want to know all about you. You interest me extremely."
Mushkin thanked her, and while eating with excellent appetite, began again repeating the story he had repeated several times that morning. The lady was more and more pleased with him. The girls, too, listened rather attentively. They worked out the relationship. It turned out that Mushkin knew his family tree fairly well, but in spite of their efforts, they could make out scarcely any connection between him and Madame Epanchin. Among the grandfathers and the grandmothers, a distant kinship might be discovered. The lady was particularly delighted with this dry subject, for she scarcely ever had a chance of indulging her tastes by discussing her pedigree. So she got up from table quite excited.
"Come, all of you, into our assembly room," she said.
and we'll have coffee there. We have a room where we all meet," she said to Mushkin, as she led him there. "My little drawing room, where we assemble and sit when we are alone, and each of us does her work. Alexandra, my eldest daughter here, plays the piano, or reads, or sews. Adelaida paints landscapes and portraits, and can never finish anything. And Aglaia sits doing nothing. I'm not much good at work, either. I can never get anything done. Well, here we are. Sit here, Prince, by the fire, and tell me something. I want to know how you tell a story. I want to be fully convinced, and when I see old Princess Bielokonski, I shall tell her all about you. I want them all to be interested in you, too. Come, tell me something." "But, Maman, it's very queer to tell a story like that," observed Adelaida, who had by now set up her easel, taken out her brushes and palette, and was setting to work copying from an engraving a landscape she had begun long ago. Alexandra and Aglaia sat down on a little sofa, and folding their arms, prepared to listen to the conversation. Mushkin observed that he was a centre of attention on all sides.
"I would never say anything if I were told to like that," observed Aglaia.
"Why not? What is there queer about it? Why shouldn't he tell me something? He has a tongue. I want to know how he can describe things. Come, anything. Tell us how you liked Switzerland, your first impression of it. You will see. He'll begin directly, and begin well, too."
"It was a strong impression," Mushkin was beginning.
"There, you see," the eager lady broke in, addressing her daughters. "He has begun."
"Do let him speak at least, Maman," said Alexandra, checking her. "This prince may be a great rogue, not an idiot at all," she whispered to Aglaia. "No doubt of it. I've seen that a long while," answered Aglaia. "And it's horrid of him to play a part. Is he trying to gain something by it?"
"My first impression was a very strong one," Mushkin repeated. "When I was brought from Russia through various German towns, I simply looked about in silence, and I remember asked no questions. That was after a long series of violent and painful attacks of my illness, and when my complaint was at its worst and my fits frequent, I always sank into complete stupefaction. I lost my memory, and though my brain worked, the logical sequence of ideas seemed broken. I couldn't connect more than two or three ideas together. That's how it seems to me. When the fits became less frequent and violent, I became strong and healthy again, as I am now. I remember I was insufferably sad. I wanted to cry. I was all the while lost in wonder and uneasiness. What affected me most was that everything was strange. I realized that. I was crushed by the strangeness of it. I was finally roused from this gloomy state, I remember, one evening on reaching Switzerland at Bâle, and I was roused by the bray of an ass in the marketplace. I was immensely struck with the ass, and for some reason extraordinarily pleased with it, and suddenly everything seemed to clear up in my head.
An ass! Well, that's odd," observed Lizaveta Prokofievna.
"Yet there's nothing odd about it. One of us may even fall in love with an ass," she observed, looking wrathfully at the laughing girls. "It's happened in mythology. Go on, Prince." "I've been awfully fond of asses ever since. They have a special attraction for me. I began to ask about them because I'd never seen one before, and I understood at once what a useful creature it was. Industrious, strong, patient, cheap, long-suffering. And so, through the ass, all Switzerland began to attract me, so that my melancholy passed completely."
"Well, that's all very strange. But you can pass over the ass. Let's come to something else. Why do you keep laughing, Aglaia? And you, Adelaida? The prince told us splendidly about the ass. He has seen it himself. But what have you seen? You've never been abroad."
"I have seen an ass, Maman," said Adelaida.
"And I've even heard one,"
asserted Aglaia. The three girls laughed again. Mushkin laughed with them.
"That's too bad of you," observed the lady. "You must excuse them, Prince. They are good-natured. I'm always quarrelling with them, but I love them. They are flighty, thoughtless madcaps."
"Why?"
laughed Mushkin. "I should have done the same in their place. But still I stand up for the ass. The ass is a good-natured and useful creature."
"And are you good-natured, Prince? I ask from curiosity," inquired Madame Epanchin.
They all laughed again.
"That hateful ass again!"
"'I wasn't thinking about it,' cried the lady. "'Believe me, Prince, I spoke without any hint. "'Oh, I believe you, certainly.'
And Mushkin went on laughing.
"'I'm glad you are laughing. "'I see you are a very good-natured young man,' said Lizaveta Prokofievna.
"'Sometimes not good-natured,' answered Mushkin.
"'I am good-natured,' the lady put in unexpectedly. "'And if you like, I am always good-natured, you may say. "'It's my one failing, for one oughtn't to be always good-natured. "'I get angry often with these girls, and still more with Ivan Fyodorovitch. "'But the worst of it is that I am always more good-natured when I am angry. "'Just before you came in I was angry and pretended that I didn't and couldn't understand anything. "'I'm like that sometimes, like a child.' "'Aglaia pulled me up. "'Thank you for the lesson, Aglaia. "'But it's all nonsense. "'I'm not quite such a fool as I seem, "'and as my daughters would like to make me out. "'I have a will of my own, and am not easily put to shame. "'But I say this without malice. "'Come here, Aglaia, give me a kiss. "'There.' "'That's fondling enough,' she observed, "'when Aglaia had with real feeling kissed her on the lips and on the hand. "'Go on, Prince.' "'Perhaps you will remember something more interesting than an ass.'
"'I don't understand how anyone can describe straight off like that,'
Adelaida observed again.
"'I couldn't think of anything. "'But the prince will think of something, for he is extremely clever, "'at least 10 times as clever as you are, very likely 12 times. "'I hope you will feel it after this. "'Prove it to them, prince. Go on. "'You really can pass over the ass now. "'What did you see abroad besides the ass?'
"'It was clever about the ass, too,'
observed Alexandra.
"'It was interesting what the prince told us of his invalid condition, "'and how one external shock made everything pleasant to him. "'I've always been interested to know how people go out of their minds and recover again, "'especially when it happens all of a sudden.'
"'Yes, yes,' cried her mother eagerly. "'I see that you can be clever sometimes, too. "'Well, come on, stop laughing. "'You were speaking of Swiss scenery, prince, I think. "'Well,' "'We reached Lucerne, and I was taken to the lake. "'I felt how beautiful it was, but I felt dreadfully depressed by it,' said Mushkin.
"'Why?'
asked Alexandra.
"'I don't know why.
"'I always feel depressed and uneasy at the sight of such a landscape for the first time. "'I feel both happy and uneasy. "'But that was all while I was still ill.
"'I should awfully like to see it,'
said Adelaida.
"'I can't understand why we don't go abroad.' "'I haven't been able to find subjects for painting for the last 2 years. "'The East and the South have been painted long ago. "'Find me a subject for a picture, Prince.
Oh, "'I know nothing about it. "'I should have thought you've only to see and to paint.
"'I don't know how to see things.
"'Why do you keep talking in riddles? "'I can't make head or tail of it,'
interrupted her mother.
"'What do you mean by not knowing how to see? "'You've got eyes. See with them.' "'If you can't see here, you won't learn how to abroad. "'Better tell us how you saw things yourself, Prince.'
"'Yes, that would be better,'
added Adelaida.
"'The Prince has learnt to see things abroad.'
"'I don't know. I simply got better abroad. "'I don't know whether I learnt to see things, "'but I was almost all the time very happy.'
"'Happy? You know how to be happy?'
cried Aglaia.
"'Then how can you say you didn't learn to see things?'
"'You might teach us, even.'
"'Please do,'
laughed Adelaida. "'I can't teach anything,' Mushkin laughed, too. "'I spend almost all my time abroad in the same Swiss village. "'I rarely went on excursions, and only to a short distance. "'What could I teach you? "'At first I was simply not dull. "'I soon began to grow stronger. "'Then every day became precious to me, "'and more precious as time went on, "'so that I began to notice it.' I used to go to bed very happy and get up happier still. But it would be hard to say why.
So you didn't want to go away? You had no desire to go anywhere?
Asked Alexandra.
At the beginning, quite at the beginning I had, and I used to become very restless. I was continually thinking of the life I would lead. I wanted to know what life had in store for me. I was particularly restless at some moments. You know, there are such moments... "'especially in solitude. "'There was a small waterfall there. "'It fell from a height on the mountain. "'Such a tiny thread, almost perpendicular, "'foaming, white and splashing. "'Though it fell from a great height, it didn't seem so high.
It was the third of a mile away, but it only looked about 50 paces. I used to like listening to the sound of it at night. At such moments I was sometimes overcome with great restlessness. Sometimes, too, at midday, I wandered on the mountains, and stood alone halfway up a mountain surrounded by great ancient resinous pine trees. On the crest of the rock, an old medieval castle in ruins. Our little village far, far below, scarcely visible. Bright sunshine, blue sky, and the terrible stillness. At such times I felt something was drawing me away, and I kept fancying that if I walked straight on, far, far away, and reached that line where sky and earth meet, there I should find the key to the mystery. There I should see a new life, a thousand times richer and more turbulent than ours. I dreamed of some great town like Naples, full of palaces, noise, roar, life. And I dreamed of all sorts of things, indeed. But afterwards, I fancied one might find a wealth of life, even in prison. "That last edifying reflection I read when I was 12 in my reader," said Aglaia. "That's all philosophy," observed Adelaida. "You are a philosopher, perhaps, and who knows, perhaps truly." "Perhaps you are right," smiled Mushkin. "I am really a philosopher, perhaps. And who knows? Perhaps I really have a notion of instructing. That's possible, truly."
"And your philosophy is just like Evlampia Nikolaevna's," Aglaia put in again. "She's the widow of a clerk who comes to see us, rather like a poor relation. Cheapness is her one object in life, to live as cheaply as possible, and she talks of nothing but farthings. And yet she has money, you know. She is sly. That's like your wealth of life in prison. Perhaps, too, your 4 years of happiness in the country for which you bartered your Naples. And you seem to have gained by the bargain, though it was a petty one."
"There may be two opinions about life in prison," said Mushkin. "The man who spent 12 years in prison told me something. He was one of the invalids in the care of my professor. He had fits. He was sometimes restless, wept, and even tried to kill himself. His life in prison had been a very sad one, I assure you, but not at all petty. Yet he had no friends but a spider and a tree that grew under his window. But I'd better tell you how I met another man last year. There was one very strange circumstance about it. Strange because such things rarely happen. This man had once been led out with others to the scaffold, and a sentence of death was read over him. He was to be shot for a political offence. 20 moments later, a reprieve was read to them, and they were condemned to another punishment instead. Yet the interval between those two sentences, 20 minutes or at least a quarter of an hour, he passed in the fullest conviction that he would die in a few minutes. I was always eager to listen when he recalled his sensations at that time, and I often questioned him about it. He remembered it all with extraordinary distinctness, and used to say that he never would forget those minutes. 20 paces from the scaffold, round which soldiers and other people were standing, there were 3 posts stuck in the ground, as there were several criminals. The 3 first were led up, bound to the posts. The death dress, a long white gown, was put on, and white caps were pulled over their eyes so that they should not see the guns. Then a company of several soldiers was drawn up against each post. My friend was the 8th on the list, so he had to be one of the 3rd set. The priest went to each in turn with a cross. He had only 5 minutes more to live. He told me that those 5 minutes seemed to him an infinite time, a vast wealth. He felt that he had so many lives left in those 5 minutes that there was no need yet to think of the last moment, so much so that he divided his time up. He set aside time to take leave of his comrades, 2 minutes for that. Then he kept another 2 minutes to think for the last time, and then a minute to look about him for the last time. He remembered very well having divided his time like that. He was dying at 27, strong and healthy. As he took leave of his comrades, he remembered asking one of them a somewhat irrelevant question, and being particularly interested in the answer. Then, when he had said goodbye, the 2 minutes came that he had set apart for thinking to himself. He knew beforehand what he would think about.
He wanted to realise as quickly and clearly as possible how it could be that now he existed and was living, and in 3 minutes he would be something, someone or something, but what? Where? He meant to decide all that in those 2 minutes. Not far off there was a church, and the gilt roof was glittering in the bright sunshine. He remembered that he stared very persistently at that roof and the light flashing from it. He could not tear himself away from the light. It seemed to him that those rays were his new nature, and that in 3 minutes he would somehow melt into them. The uncertainty and feeling of aversion for that new thing which would be and was just coming was awful. But he said that nothing was so dreadful at that time as the continual thought, what if I were not to die? What if I could go back to life? What eternity? And it would all be mine. I would turn every minute into an age. I would lose nothing. I would count every minute as it passed. I would not waste one. He said that this idea turned to such a fury at last that he longed to be shot quickly. Mushkin suddenly ceased speaking. Everyone expected him to go on and draw some conclusion.
"Have you finished?" asked Aglaé.
"What?" "Yes," said Mushkin, rousing himself from a momentary dreaminess.
"But what did you tell that story for?"
"Oh, something in our talk reminded me of it."
"You are very disconnected," observed Alexandra. "You probably meant to show Prince that not one instant of life can be considered petty, and that sometimes 5 minutes is a precious treasure. That's all very laudable, but let me ask, how did that friend who told you such horrors—" "He was reprieved. So he was presented with that eternity of life. What did he do with that wealth afterwards? Did he live counting each moment?"
"Oh, no. He told me himself. I asked him about that, too. He didn't live like that at all. He wasted many, many minutes."
"Well, there you have it tried. So it seems it's impossible, really, to live counting each moment. For some reason, it's impossible."
"Yes, for some reason it is impossible," repeated Mushkin. "I thought so myself, and yet I somehow can't believe it."
"Then you think you will live more wisely than anyone?" said Aglaé.
"Yes, I have thought that too sometimes."
"And you think so still?"
"Yes, I think so still," answered Mushkin, looking at Aglaé with the same gentle and even timid smile. But he laughed again at once and looked gaily at her.
"That's modest," said Aglaé almost irritably.
"But how brave you are. You laugh. But I was so impressed by his story that I dreamt of it afterwards. I dreamt of that 5 minutes." Once more he looked earnestly and searchingly from one to another of his listeners. "You're not angry with me for anything?" he asked suddenly, seeming embarrassed but looking them straight in the face.
"What for?"
cried the three young ladies in surprise. "Why, because I seem all the while to be preaching to you." They all laughed. "If you are angry, don't be," he said. "I know for myself that I have lived less than others, and that I know less of life than anyone. Perhaps I talk very queerly at times." And he was overwhelmed with confusion.
"If you're happy, as you say, you must have lived more, not less than others. Why do you make a pretense and apologize?"
Aglaé persisted naggingly.
"And please don't mind about preaching to us. It's no sign of superiority on your part. With your quietism, one might fill 100 years of life with happiness. If one shows you an execution, or if one holds out one's finger to you, you will draw equally edifying reflections from both and be quite satisfied. Life is easy like that."
"I can't make out why you're so cross," said Madame Panchin, who had been watching the speakers' faces for some time. "And I can't make out what you are talking about either. Why, a finger? What nonsense! The prince talks splendidly, only rather sadly. Why do you discourage him? When he began, he was laughing, and now he is quite glum."
"It's all right, Mamel. But it's a pity you haven't seen an execution, Prince. I should like to have asked you one question."
"I have seen an execution," answered Mushkin.
"You have?"
cried Aglaé.
"I ought to have guessed it. That's the last straw. "'If you've seen that, how can you say that you were happy all the time? "'Didn't I tell you the truth?'
"'But do they have executions in your village?' asked Adelaida.
"'I saw it at Lyon. "'I visited the town with Schneider. "'He took me with him. "'We chanced upon it directly we arrived.
"'Well, did you like it? "'Was there much that was edifying and instructive?' asked Aglaia.
"'I did not like it at all, and I was rather ill afterwards. "'But I must confess I was riveted to the spot. "'I could not take my eyes off it.'
"'I couldn't have taken my eyes off it either,' said Aglaia.
"'They don't like women to look on at it. "'They even write about such women in the papers.
"'I suppose if they consider that it's not fit for women, "'they mean to infer, and so justify it, that it is fit for men. "'I congratulate them on their logic. "'And you think so too, no doubt. "'Tell us about the execution,'
Adelaida interrupted.
"'I don't feel at all inclined to now.' "'Mushkin was confused and almost frowned.
"'You seem to grudge telling us about it,'
Aglaia said tauntingly.
"'No, but I've just been describing that execution.'
"'Describing it to whom?'
"'To your footman, while I was waiting.'
"'To which footman?'
he heard on all sides.
"'The one who sits in the entry, with grey hair and a red face. "'I sat in the entry waiting to see Ivan Fyodorovich.'
"'That's odd,' said the general's wife. "'The prince is a democrat,'
Aglaia rapped out.
"'Well, if you told Alexei about it, you can't refuse us.' "'I simply must hear about it,' said Adelaida.
"'One thought came into my mind just now,' Mushkin said to her, growing rather more eager again. He seemed easily roused to confiding eagerness. "'When you asked me for a subject for a picture to suggest that you should paint the face of the condemned man the moment before the blade falls, when he is still standing on the scaffold before he lies down on the plank.'
"'The face?' "'The face alone?' asked Adelaida. "'That would be a strange subject. "'And what sort of picture would it make?'
"'I don't know.'
"'Why not?' Mushkin insisted warmly.
"'I saw a picture like that at Bâle not long ago. "'I should like to tell you about it. "'I'll tell you about it some day. "'It struck me very much.'
"'You shall certainly tell us afterwards about the picture at Bâle,' said Adelaida. "'And now explain the picture of this execution.' "'Can you tell me how you imagine it to yourself? "'How is one to draw the face? "'Is it to be only the face? "'What sort of a face is it?'
"'It's practically the minute before death,' "'Mushkin began with perfect readiness, "'carried away by his memories, "'and to all appearance, instantly forgetting everything else. "'That moment when he has just mounted the ladder "'and has just stepped onto the scaffold. "'Then he glanced in my direction. "'I looked at his face.' "'And I understood it all. "'But how can one describe it? "'I do wish that you or someone would paint it. "'It would be best if it were you. "'I thought at the time that a picture of it would do good. "'You know one has to imagine everything that has been before. "'Everything, everything. "'He has been in prison, awaiting execution for a week at least. "'He has been reckoning on the usual formalities.' "'on the sentence being forwarded somewhere for signature "'and not coming back again for a week. "'But now, by some chance, this business was over sooner. "'At 5 o'clock in the morning he was asleep. "'It was at the end of October. "'At 5 o'clock it was still cold and dark. "'The superintendent of the prison came in quietly with the guard "'and touched him carefully on the shoulder. "'He sat up, leaning on his elbow, saw the light, asked... "'What's the matter? "'The execution is at 10 o'clock. "'He was half awake and couldn't take it in, "'and began objecting that the sentence wouldn't be ready for a week. "'But when he was fully awake, he left off protesting and was silent, "'so I was told. "'Then he said, "'But it's hard it should be so sudden. "'And again he was silent and wouldn't say anything more. "'The next 3 or 4 hours are spent on the usual things, "'seeing the priest... "'Breakfast, at which he is given wine, coffee, and beef. "'Isn't that a mockery? "'Only think how cruel it is. "'Yet on the other hand, would you believe it, "'these innocent people act in good faith "'and are convinced that it's humane. "'Then the toilet. "'Do you know what a criminal's toilet is? "'And at last they take him through the town to the scaffold.
I think that he too must have thought he had an endless time left to live while he was being driven through the town. He must have thought on the way, "There's a long time left. 3 streets more. I shall pass through this one, then through the next. Then there's that one left, where there's a baker's on the right. It'll be a long time before we get to the baker's." There were crowds of people. There was noise and shouting. 10,000 faces. 10,000 eyes. All that he has had to bear. And worst of all, the thought, they are 10,000. But not one of them is being executed. And I am to be executed. Well, all that is preparatory. There is a ladder to the scaffold. Suddenly, at the foot of the ladder, he began to cry. And he was a strong, manly fellow. He had been a great criminal, I was told. The priest never left him for a moment. He drove with him in the cart and talked with him all the while. I doubt whether he heard. He might begin listening and would not understand more than 2 words. So it must have been. At last he began going up the ladder. His legs were tied together so that he could only move with tiny steps. The priest, who must have been an intelligent man, left off speaking and only gave him the cross to kiss. At the foot of the ladder he was very pale, and when he was at the top and standing on the scaffold, he became as white as paper, as white as writing paper. His legs must have grown weak and wooden, and I expect he felt sick, as though something were choking him, and that made a sort of tickling in his throat. Have you ever felt that, when you were frightened, or in awful moments when all your reason is left, but it has no power? I think that if one is faced by inevitable destruction, if a house is falling upon you, for instance, one must feel a great longing to sit down, close one's eyes and wait, come what may. When that weakness was beginning, the priest, with a rapid movement, hastily put the cross to his lips, a little plain silver cross. He kept putting it to his lips every minute. And every time the cross touched his lips, he opened his eyes and seemed for a few seconds to come to life again, and his legs moved. He kissed the cross greedily. He made haste to kiss, as though in haste not to forget to provide himself with something in case of need. But I doubt whether he had any religious feeling at the time. And so it was till he was laid on the plank. It's strange that people rarely faint at these last moments. On the contrary, the brain is extraordinarily lively and must be working at a tremendous rate. At a tremendous rate, like a machine at full speed. I fancy that there is a continual throbbing of ideas of all sorts, always unfinished and perhaps absurd too, quite irrelevant ideas. That man is looking at me. He has a wart on his forehead. One of the executioner's buttons is rusty. And yet all the while one knows and remembers everything. There is one point which can never be forgotten, and one can't faint, and everything moves and turns about it, about that point. And only think that it must be like that up to the last quarter of a second, when his head lies on the block and he waits and knows, and suddenly hears above him the clang of the iron. He must hear that. If I were lying there, I should listen on purpose and hear. It may last only the tenth part of a second, but one would be sure to hear it. And only fancy, it's still disputed whether, when the head is cut off, it knows for a second after that it has been cut off. What an idea! And what if it knows it for 5 seconds? Paint the scaffold so that only the last step can be distinctly seen in the foreground, and the criminal, having just stepped on it, his head, his face as white as paper, the priest holding up the cross, the man greedily putting forward his blue lips and looking, and aware of everything. The cross and the head. That's the picture. The priest's face and the executioner's, his 2 attendants and a few heads and eyes below, might be painted in the background, in half light as the setting. That's the picture. Mushkin ceased speaking and looked at them all.
"That's nothing like quietism, certainly," said Alexandra to herself.
"And now tell us how you were in love," said Adelaida.
Mushkin looked at her with astonishment.
"Listen," Adelaida said, seeming rather hurried. "You promised to tell us about the Baal picture, but now I should like to hear how you have been in love. Don't deny it, you must have been. Besides, as soon as you begin describing anything, you cease to be a philosopher."
"As soon as you finish telling us anything, you seem to be ashamed of what you've said,"
Aglaia observed suddenly.
"Why is that?"
"How stupid that is," snapped her mother, looking indignantly at Aglaia.
"It's not clever,"
Alexandra assented.
"Don't believe her, Prince," said Madame Epanchin, turning to him. "She does it on purpose from a sort of malice. She has really not been so badly brought up. Don't think the worse of them for teasing you like this. They must be up to some mischief. But they like you already, I know. I know their faces."
"I know their faces, too," said Mushkin with peculiar emphasis.
"What do you mean?"
asked Adelaida curiously.
"What do you know about our faces?"
the two others inquired, too. But Mushkin did not speak and was grave. They all waited for his answer.
"I'll tell you afterwards," he said gently and gravely.
"You're trying to rouse our curiosity," cried Aglaia. "And what solemnity!"
"Very well,"
Adelaida interposed hurriedly again.
"But if you are such a connoisseur in faces, you certainly must have been in love. So I guessed right. Tell us about it."
"I haven't been in love," answered Mushkin, as gently and gravely as before. "I have been happy in a different way."
"How? In what?"
"Very well. I'll tell you," said Mushkin, as though meditating profoundly.